And what the indicator has shown is a fairly sharp rebound from the sort of the bottom of this recession. And it suggests that we're getting close to now growing sort of a trend growth. We're still a little bit below that, but the trajectory of the indicator indicates that we're coming out of this recession.
Welcome to the Alter Group podcast on real estate. I'm your host, Tom Silva. Today, our guest is Rick Matune, senior economist and economic advisor at the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. Rick is also a lecturer at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University and was previously policy advisor for economic development, energy, and telecommunications to the governor of Washington. Rick, I want to open by asking you about a report that was recently issued by the Chicago Federal Reserve saying that the recession is effectively over. Give me a sense of how you arrived at that conclusion.
The Chicago Fed's National Activity Index is something that we've put together. And just so people are clear, it takes 85 different indicators, sort of jams them into a black box, and then gives a reading to the U.S. economic health. And what it's trying to show is whether or not the U.S. economy is growing at sort of historic trend growth relative to GDP. And what the indicator has shown is a fairly sharp rebound from the sort of the bottom of this recession. And it suggests that we're getting close to now growing sort of a trend growth. We're still a little bit below that, but the trajectory of the indicator indicates that we're coming out of this recession. Now, that being said, the one thing that you should realize when you're looking at this indicator is it's mostly driven by output-related measures. So that's one of the tensions people are feeling right now in this economy, which is the economy can be growing based on output, but they're not seeing improvement in things like jobs or necessarily credit availability. So it's the type of thing where we're coming out of this recession, but to a lot of people, it probably doesn't feel like we're out of the recession.
So I want to ask you about the stimulus, $787 billion. How much at this point has actually been spent and is making its way through our economy?
It's really hard to tell in a lot of ways. I mean, in terms of money that's actually been released, I mean, in terms of what's gone to the states, roughly about a third to a half, depending on the state, has actually sort of made it into state budgets. The parts that were more immediate were things that had to do with changes to tax codes, so sort of some of the tax rebates that were included in the stimulus went out pretty fast, and sort of a lot of the matching funds, again, went out pretty fast. The issue with it is that some of the money was really designed more to sort of just stabilize sort of economic conditions, so it's a little bit of a misnomer to call it stimulus money because it frankly was just more aimed at stabilizing sort of positions. The part that's more stimulus related is more related to the infrastructure funds that have gone out. And that's going to take longer to sort of flow into the economy because, again, it's construction related. So it you know, depends on when this stuff actually gets built, when it's actually through the bidding process and all those sorts of areas. So it's harder to measure exactly when that's going to be felt.
Now, the concept of a stimulus requires that ultimately private demand will replace the stimulus money in the economy. So it's supposed to have a multiplier effect on consumption, on investment. But that only works if you've got pent-up demand. And so the question is, after going through the entire 90s and most of the 2000s with incredible amounts of spending, incredible amounts of credit, just how much pent-up demand is left in the economy?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. And I think that's one of the biggest concerns that many economists have. Some economists who are fans of the so-called W-shaped recession suggest that that's exactly what will happen, that once the federal stimulus wears off, that there is, in fact, no pent-up private sector demand to fill in behind it. On the, you know, sort of the opposite side of that is a suggestion that you are seeing growth in demand outside the U.S., so particularly in Asia and in other markets, you're seeing sort of some pent-up demand there that's being released, and that the U.S. will be in a position to take advantage of that. Some of the gains you're seeing in manufacturing right now are really export-related. So the idea is you will have fill-in there. I think the point which you make, which is really important, is one concern is there isn't a lot of consumer pent-up demand coming out of this particular recession. And you can see that in a number of ways. I mean, again, while auto sales are up, they're still at very depressed levels relative to where they were, say, 2 or 3 years ago in terms of of housing, you're still looking at drawing down a pretty significant level of inventory before people are really going to be in a position where they're going to go out and aggressively buy housing. So two of the things that usually are sort of markers for pent-up demand this time around are really sort of missing in the consumer behavior.
Now, one of the concerns with massive government spending and with foreign investors, for example, asking for higher yields on things like T-bills is inflation. But for inflation to occur, you really have to have a tight labor market. So give us a sense of how we should be thinking about the chances of inflation.
It doesn't appear that there's really much inflationary pressures right now. And again, I think you identified the right reasons, which is there's lots of output gaps right now in the U.S. economy. So, you know, for example, one place inflation could come from would be if there was a lot of pressure for wage growth. At this point, with, you know, fairly high unemployment rates and that expected to sort of be maintained through the next couple of years, unfortunately, there's not going to be a lot of ability for wages to sort of move up aggressively. Similarly, with slack consumer demand, it's going to be very hard to get much pricing ability for retailers. So that also is going to keep pressure down on inflation. So again, it's sort of hard to, you know, to say within the next several years where inflation would come from, given these sort of slack conditions in the U.S. economy.
Now, Rick, if the stimulus doesn't create inflation, one of the places it could come from is the money supply. And here I'm going back to Friedmanite monetarism, but give me a sense of whether there's a concern with the fact that we've expanded the money supply by $1.2 trillion in the last year.
It's clearly a concern. I mean, you know, obviously we've expanded the amount of money in circulation pretty significantly as part of the ability to stabilize the U.S. economy. From the Fed's perspective, I think that one of the things that we feel is the ability to have more tools for sort of controlling the money supply in the future. So, you know, beyond the traditional ability to adjust the Fed funds rate to sort of tamp down inflation, we're also fairly, we feel we have the ability to now manipulate our balance sheet and the timing of when asset sales that would also have the ability to sort of adjust how inflation might track coming out of this. The final thing, too, is we can now pay interest on reserves on account at the Federal Reserve, which is also another new tool that we have. And we feel that that's another ability for us to sort of be able to control, money supply growth in the future. And again, to be able to sort of manage the inflationary picture as we come out of this.
Rick, I want to ask you about what for most people is the number one concern about this recession, which is jobs. We've lost 7.4 million jobs. And there are estimates that it'll take up to 7 years for us to get back to pre-recession employment levels. Are you surprised by that number?
One of the things that was different about this particular recession was the pattern of job loss, which, as you saw, even sectors that traditionally have never lost jobs, losing jobs in this particular recession. So even things like health and education and areas like that, which traditionally are pretty bulletproof when it comes to recessions, felt the pressure this time around. In terms of future job creation, that's also hard because you have to get to a point where businesses are going to feel fairly confident about demand filling in before they're going to really be aggressive in terms of hiring. Now, the one positive sign we've seen has been an uptick in hiring at temporary employment agencies. And that's usually considered a good harbinger of what future demand will be. That once you see temp services agencies starting to push employment levels up, that indicates there could be future hiring. Another interesting theory about this particular recession in terms of jobs is the idea that companies adjusted their employment levels much more aggressively at the beginning of this cycle. And this suggests that they're leaner at this point than they normally would have been given where they would have, what they would have done in previous recessions. And that suggests that they may hire faster coming out of this, so that there's a possibility that you could see the job number actually getting better faster than you would have expected given the depth of this recession.
Now, jobs have been a concern even previous to the recession. We generated a third as many jobs during the 2000s as we did during the 90s. So it begs the question, what has shifted in our economy that's causing that?
Well, again, that's a good question. And one of the things that at least most economists have looked at is the changing structure of our labor market. So one of the things you see today is when you have layoffs, they tend to be more structural than cyclical. So we have sort of a skills mismatch right now in the U.S. economy. So in many cases, people who have lost their jobs simply don't have the right skills to be employed in fields that are growing. So, you know, one of the challenges that lays before us is a sort of a retraining effort that needs to occur, which is to take people who are moving out of fields where they have a certain skill set that's no longer really in demand in the U.S. economy. And that's a very difficult proposition to sort of manage. You know, even in areas like manufacturing, where before you didn't necessarily need the same sort of, say, you know, post-secondary education, today increasingly you do need those kinds of skills because just it's become a much more sophisticated sort of structure. And so therefore there's a whole need for people to sort of get these higher training levels to be able to succeed in the economy that exists today.
Now, looking ahead, we've got the Fed relatively bullish with a forecast of 4%. For this year in terms of GDP growth, and the World Bank being relatively conservative with 2.7%. Give us a sense of how we should be thinking about some of the numbers that we're seeing and how they're being benchmarked and to what extent we can draw anything meaningful from them.
A good example recently was last week's release of the GDP number. GDP grew at 5.7%. Obviously, that was great news for the U.S. economy. But if you stripped out inventories, which made up the bulk of that growth, the U.S. economy only grew at 2.2%. So therefore, the underlying sort of sustainable part of GDP, the growth was actually relatively muted. But the headline number would give you the sense that the U.S. economy was sort of booming. And this was, again, almost entirely driven by inventories.
Right, because they tend to be one-time events or cyclical.
Yeah, mostly it's an inventory cycle. So in the past, what we'd been seeing before this was inventories were actually dragging down the GDP number. And now you've had a turn in the inventory cycle that's been adding to GDP growth.
Rick, I want to ask you about interest rates. Right now, we're at a historically low level. And every time the Fed has held interest rates down, people who would have normally invested in things like T-bills have to go elsewhere. And where they go is more risk and higher yields, which could potentially create another asset bubble. Give me a sense if that's a real concern right now.
You know, one of the concerns is, as you say, is as you take people and encourage them to take riskier behavior simply because they can't get returns and other sorts of things, that you do have this potential for bubbles. And there's been certainly people who have speculated that we've had bubbles in certain commodity markets at this point and in other things as people sort of chased higher returns. You know, again, at this point, I wouldn't say that we think that's a sort of systematic behavior. It clearly was one of the things that got us into this previous situation was sort of abnormally low interest rates appeared to have been one of the things that at least many economists felt caused the housing bubble, although again that's open to a lot of debate at this point. So, you know, given sort of the recent history, it would be foolish not to sort of pay attention to those indicators, but it'd be hard pressed to say right now that that's anything that's occurring systematically.
Rick, I want to focus for our audience a little bit more specifically on real estate. Real estate was 60% of all the lending in our economy. And right now, commercial real estate loans that are about $3.5 trillion. As we move into the next cycle, the big imperative is deleveraging. And I'm wondering what the impact will be on the industry.
The first thing, obviously, it's going to have downward pressure on prices. And you know, one of the things that you're seeing at this point is a lot of sort of price discovery occurring in all these markets because people are trying to figure out what is the underlying value of these assets to begin with. And clearly, some of that has been called into question. The issue really, I think, is one is sort of the short-run effect versus the long-run effect. And I think that in many cases, probably some of the buildings are going to be under, you know, too much short-run pressure relative to what the long-run potential is in the market, and that some of these assets will recover in value, you know, if you just trace out sort of underlying demographics and sort of what's happening in specific urban areas. The issue, though, is for deleveraging is again, it's a very painful process of sort of marking down things to a level that probably represents something that was what prices were in 2006 or 2007, pick a year, you know, in terms of that.
So. Now, part of the process of deleveraging is having the banks, the thrifts, the special services, and the FDIC mark to market, so essentially discounting the property and then putting it back into circulation. In a recent survey, 60% say that the government has caused a delay in the discounting and sale of assets. Do you think that's fair?
Well, it's a hard one to do. I mean, one of the things that happened was the FDIC was charged with this PIP program, which was set up. And that was, you know, the idea was exactly that, to sort of, you know, evaluate the most toxic stuff and then sort of re-securitize it and sell it back into the market. But, you know, the issue in most cases was, again, was these are very, you know, heterogeneous assets. So it's very hard to come up with a price for them. The other issue was sort of, if you were going to repackage these things, sort of what tranches would you sell these things off in? I mean, some of the stuff is sort of only marginally not performing versus that stuff that's truly toxic. So the whole issue of sort of getting a fair price has been very, very difficult. And it's created some friction within the market because, again, nobody really knows what it is they're buying in many of these cases. So I think one of the issues, again, is sort of establishing these sort of market prices once you sort of deleverage what the value of these assets are. And then once you have those sorts of prices, then it's going to be easier for investors to figure out what it is they're buying and what they're paying for it.
Now, isn't part of the issue for banks the impact of write-downs on their book capital ratios?
Yeah, for the large banks, I mean, they went through the stress test process, and one of the things that allowed regulators to do was get a sense of exactly how exposed they were in these various markets and what their relative health was. The problem is for commercial real estate, a lot of the lending was done at sort of regional and smaller banks, and they weren't part of the stress test process. And so one of the issues for them is figuring out exactly what their balance sheets are, and then also having to hit their capital requirements, which is in many cases making them very reluctant to make loans because, again, they're trying to build capital against potential future losses. So that's a pressure that clearly regulators are putting on these banks that makes it hard for them necessarily to, you know, be aggressive in terms of lending, and in many cases it encourages them to, you know, try to, the, you know, pretend and extend that you had suggested as sort of a structure because, again, obviously then they don't have to raise the capital against the potential loss.
Now, I want to touch briefly on institutional investors and an idea that was floated that the government should be involved and guaranteeing returns to entities like pension funds. Give me a sense of your thoughts about that.
Yeah, it was an interesting idea. I mean, originally it was looking at the subprime housing market, and there was one proposal that was being bounced around Congress, which suggested that what you're really looking for at this time is very patient capital. So the issue is a lot of these assets will recover their prices sometime in the future, but if you're in a position where you can't be patient, you're not going to be, you know, able to invest in those things. So the notion was that pension funds could fill this particular role because obviously they don't necessarily need all of their assets to pay out current pensioners. The notion is they could have invested in these things, bought them, held them to maturity, or hold them for a longer period of time until the asset values recover. But to make these attractive to pension funds, what you would have to do is have the federal government probably come in and give them some sort of guarantee that would suggest that they would at least get what their average return was for the fund if they had invested in other things. So say if that was their historic return was 7.5%, the federal government would guarantee them a 7.5% return on these particular investments. If they got the 7.5%, the federal government wouldn't give them anything. If they came in under, the federal government would fill in the back the amount that they wouldn't have received. And if they were over that, they just would keep the excess. So that was the idea behind it. You know, the pressure, why that hasn't gone forward very much is because the largest pension funds you'd be you're looking at would be state and local government pension funds, which are right now significantly underfunded on a national basis. So while this might be attractive in terms of their own investments, it would be very hard for a lot of these funds to actually enter into these sorts of things when they're looking at sort of making up their own returns at this point to move into a higher risky, more risky investment category.
Now, the size of our national debt has become a great source of concern. It essentially doubled between 2001 and 2008 from about $5.6 trillion to $10.7 trillion. The new budget that the Obama administration has just unveiled has $1.3 trillion in deficit spending. Give us a sense of how we should be thinking about debt. Should we be concerned about it, or should we follow the line that's been advanced by people like Paul Krugman, that the deficit is relatively small when compared to the size of our GDP?
There's certainly a sense of that. I mean, you know, a lot depends on what the future growth potential is of the U.S. economy. And again, the level of debt always has to be adjusted relative to whether or not the U.S. is still an attractive investment for investors. And you know, one of the things you saw is even at the very worst of this recession, you saw lots of funds coming into the U.S., particularly to buy treasury bills, which, given that the shape our economy was in, was still suggesting that most people considered the U.S. the best investment out there, even in the very precarious economy. So there's still a sense in which, you know, the world's largest economy, we're obviously a great consumer base for anybody who wants to invest in us. And there's a sense in which, you know, the debt levels are still within the range of being manageable. Again, you don't want to saddle future generations with having to pay this off. And you're right. I mean, right now, a lot of the concern is will future generations, in fact, be sort of worse off than current generations as they sort of take on these additional burdens? And, you know, just demographically, it's going to be challenging for a lot of these future generations to sort of meet the needs given the size of the baby boomer generation that's going to be retiring.
Rick, I want to ask you about the plans to reform the banking system. The idea is to limit the amount of speculative trading on insured deposits, so to separate the investment banks from the commercial banks. So is this essentially a reinstatement of the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933?
It's more limited than Glass-Steagall was, in the sense that the range of bank investments is different. That would be, you know, limited in terms of the actual what's being referred to as the Volcker Rule that's being proposed. I think the notion behind it, at least as it's been explained, is that you want to simply, you know, sort of de-risk the banks and make it clearer that you have banks that are in a position where they're not able to take these kind of positions. So therefore, it's clear what their relationship is to federal support in terms of either whether it be, you know, guarantees on deposits or other things like that. And then there would be a class of you know, highly risk-taking banks. So therefore, consumers would be better informed as to what the nature of the businesses were. So that part of it makes it simpler than, say, trying to go through some sort of elaborate regulatory reform, which would look at sort of, you know, which would assume that the regulator would get in a position that they could actually sort of constantly monitor banks' conditions and positions and you know, constantly prod them to sort of adjust themselves on a risk-return basis. So that part makes it seem somewhat easier for, I think, average people to understand what the proposal is. You know, the issue, I think, for a lot of people is for banks, it would obviously challenge a lot of their sort of future earnings. I mean, these are areas in which they've sort of grown as sort of profit centers within their business. So I think they're obviously they're going to be somewhat resistant to this kind of proposal. And again, the notion is it does it truly de-risk the economy if you're just setting up other bodies that then would continue to take these kind of positions?
And will it raise the cost of capital if hedge funds and private equity funds cannot tap into insured deposits?
Yeah, you clearly could consider that being a possibility because, again, if you're putting them in these positions where they're truly high-risk operations and they don't have the deposit base, you would put them in a position where potentially it would be, you know, harder to raise capital and they would have to charge more for whatever the borrowers were looking for.
Now, isn't it true that part of what's really hurting the banking sector is the fact that the secondary markets have dried up? I mean, you look at credit card companies as an example. if they can't securitize those loans on the bond market, then essentially it takes away a major source of liquidity.
That's a really good question. I think there's some people are saying that there seems to be a little bit more of an appetite at this point for doing securitizations. I mean, there have been a couple of small CMBS deals that have gone forward, but obviously the levels almost evaporated off of what it previously was.
The CMBS market being down by 90%.
Exactly. So, but the fact that even there have been any of these have been sort of seen as a little bit of a sense in which some liquidity might be coming back. I think one of the things that will come out of this will be sort of new instruments for injecting liquidity. I think you've identified a really important point, because if you look at sort of spreads, asset price spreads at this point, they've basically sort of come back to where they were pre, Lehman collapsing. And so therefore you're suggesting that sort of, the prices are roughly where they should be, but what you're not seeing is either the deal flow or the liquidity that you would expect given what those sort of levels are at this point. So there's still obviously an issue as to sort of how do you sort of make these things more liquid. And I think one of the things that most firms learned coming out of this, and I think this has been a painful lesson, is that firms are going to pay a premium for liquidity at this point. They're going to be looking for, if they take on a particular asset, how easily is it? Can they liquidate it, and exactly on what terms can they liquidate it? Because a lot of firms, getting caught in a cash crunch was one of the real issues that they faced in this recession.
Rick, I want to ask you about the issue of moral hazard in our economy, and the idea that companies tend to behave differently when they're insulated from risk. The phrase that's caused a lot of consternation is too big to fail. So I want to ask you, going forward, if the principle of moral hazard is one that you think should still apply.
Yeah, well, I think almost all economists, I mean, moral hazard is one of the core beliefs in economics that is something that you have to be concerned with. And I think probably the biggest thing coming out of this particular recession has been the whole notion of how do you allow organizations that are considered too big to fail in some reasonable way. A lot of what occurred in this last recession was having to come in and rescue organizations because of how systemically involved they were in the U.S. economy. In many cases, you were looking at organizations that simply had too many counterparties that you couldn't let them fail because the effect they would have had on other organizations, other banks, other investment houses throughout the economy. So I think if there's one thing that's definitely been learned is we need a way to get through a structured bankruptcy that allows you to take any organization and put it through bankruptcy rather than relying on a government bailout or some other bailout just to keep it alive. So hopefully that's something we're going to learn through this. The other issue which you raised is again the sort of the price of risk. And if you look at what conditions were going into this, you can pretty well see that risk was pretty systematically underpriced. And in many cases, this was a product of a lot of very sophisticated econometric models that investment houses were using, which suggested that this was the appropriate price for risk for various tranches of what they were trying to sell off. And what's clear is that the models didn't capture what in fact was the underlying risk in these things. So I think people will be a lot more diligent at sort of looking at those things and questioning the assumptions that go into those.
Now, Rick, you attended the University of Chicago, which is probably the hotbed of economic debate today. And I want to ask you about one of the big discourses that's happening right now between the old line Friedmanites, the people who believed in rational expectations and efficient markets and the idea that the market would self-regulate, and the neo-Keynesians, the people like Richard Posner, who believe that the government has an enormous role to play in the economy. Now, given the fact that the current stimulus is 19% of our GDP, where if you look at every post-World War II recession, it was closer to about 3%, where do we stand with regards to this debate, and what does it bode for the future in terms of our economy?
For one thing, is I think for a lot of the sort of Chicago school traditionalists, it's been a very humbling time, because I think a lot of the rational expectation models wouldn't have predicted anywhere near the kind of behaviors or anything we have. An interesting trend has sort of been the rise of behavioral economics as sort of a new aspect of looking at this, which looks far more at sort of consumer perceptions and individual perceptions for understanding why people take risk or when they take risk or those sorts of things. And I think those can inform a lot of sort of future sort of discussions in economics. Clearly, one of the things that was shown in this is that in many cases, the data doesn't reflect anything that's changed in terms of consumer behavior or in terms of consumer expectations or in terms of investor behavior. And so when you price in historic data into sort of models, you get, essentially relationships that reflect what the historic pattern is, but it doesn't reflect if there's a trend break. And, clearly one of the things that occurred in this recession was very different behavior that wasn't getting picked up in any sort of, traditional University of Chicago type econometric models. So I think it's a healthy debate. I think it'll probably enrich economics going forward, and we'll probably have better ability to sort of understand the various dimensions of the economy.
Well, Rick, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me.
To listen to more Alter Group podcasts or to read our Alter Now blog, visit www.altergroup.com.